really have to be a partner in your care. I've been in inpatient a few times, and I always wanted to know exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it. And you have a right as a human being to know that stuff. You know, you're not just checking into the hospital and saying, "Well, here's my body, do what you want." You know, it's like, no, you need to ask questions, and you need to wait until you get the answers that tell you exactly what they're going to do to your body.
The healthcare professionals should see the patient as part of the healthcare team. And when you do that, everything goes much better. Generally speaking, sometimes people aren't really up to being part of the team, but in general, the patient knows the patient's body and condition better than anybody because they're having the experience. They can contribute to the discussion parts that would otherwise be missed.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, Scoop and John discuss the subjects that have been keeping them awake at night or irritating them during the day. We dissect medical care and doctor-patient involvement, news sources and newspapers, conflicted conservatives, nuclear war, and vegans versus carnivores.
Hey everybody, welcome to yet another episode of the Plutopia News Network. We took a little break, which will be explained in part on this particular episode. We are here today, just Scoop and I, sans any guests, and we have things to talk about. And I believe we should start with Scoop. Scoop, what's been happening in your world?
All sorts of medical crises, actually. And I've always wondered, you know, how great the medical care was in Austin. And in recent months, I found out it's pretty darn good. In most cases, you know, there are some strange things that I have problems with, but the medical care part is great. The business side seems to need a little work, but it always does. Because back just 2 weeks, but not 2 weeks, 2 days before Thanksgiving, my wife fell and broke her ankle, a very severe break, and had to rush her into Del Seton at University of Texas, a great hospital. I came to, I'd never had any experience with that, but I came to find out that they're quite good as a teaching hospital.
And yeah, this is one thing I learned about. I have had some connections with Del Seton and with, you know, I have no real medical background, you know, no formal education, but I have worked with something called participatory medicine. And I became part of a group of people who sort of support the hospital networks here in Austin as a set of volunteers. And I did go to a meeting at Del Seton right after they opened, actually. And they were very clear that they are a hospital that's dedicated, well, their hospital and the teaching school there, the medical school at UT, which is a fairly new medical school. It wasn't there before. They're dedicated to innovative approaches to medicine. They have a very open mind, and they stay abreast of the most advanced thinking and the most advanced techniques in medicine. And they teach those, and they also try to expand on those.
Yeah, I'll have to agree on that because, you know, I do have a sizable career in medicine that I don't usually talk about. For 39 years, almost 40, I was with Kaiser Permanente Medical Care in California, and that's where I met my wife, Claressa. She was an accountant in their headquarters office in Oakland, and I was in billing and claims there in the same headquarters. We billed for the entire operation in California. They have many hospitals and clinics there. And billing and claims is quite important for any medical group because that's where the money comes and goes. And I had the challenge of transitioning from the business side to the IT side and helped design, build, and support their online, their first online billing and claim system. So I got to learn all about the computer-driven side of Medicare, medical care, and worked in the National IT campus in Pleasanton. We actually bought the old PeopleSoft headquarters from Oracle and took over that. So it's quite an operation. And so I got to know how that's supposed to work. And in Texas, I found out billing and claims is a sometimes thing, and it's really scattered because there is, you know, Kaiser Permanente would send you one bill for everything because all the doctors, all the labs, all the x-ray, it's all internal. There are very few external providers, whereas you go to a hospital here, you'll have the hospital, and they're going to send you a bill. And you also have the doctor who has their own practice, and they have a separate billing system. The x-ray people, separate. Anesthesiologists, they're separate, generally. And so on and so on. You just about everyone that provides care has their own medical group. And you end up receiving numerous, and I mean numerous bills, and none of them speak to each other. So I spent the last, well, I mean, every time Clarissa had an admit and treatment, I spent a lot of time calling up each and every person who sent us a bill saying, oh, you owe all of this. We don't have any insurance. It's like, no, I have really good insurance. And so I'd have to walk them through it. And it was every single one. And I kind of discussed that with the business people at Dell Seaton. And they said, well, you know, we send it to them, but a lot of times they don't read it. So there's not a lot of it doesn't sound like there's a lot of electronic communication. They're just sending over a packet of bills. It's kind of where we were at Kaiser Permanente back in the early 1990s before we went electronic. So I'm hoping they're going to improve that because that's just one additional burden that people have to deal with, you know, over and above their loved one or themselves having to, you know, have medical treatment and trying to recover. And it certainly adds a burden to it. But, you know, I was impressed as far as the medical care at Dell Seaton. It was exceptional. And the people there, you know, my wife just fell in love with all of them. She just charmed them. And in fact, they just called, one of her nurses just called today to ask how she's doing. And she said, aren't you the woman that had those beautiful flowers? Some guy I know named Lebkowski and his wife, Marcia, sent these amazing flowers that made her day, made her entire hospital stay. And when she left, she gave the flowers, which are still looking great, she gave them to the nursing station. So, you know, the people there really seem to care. Especially the nursing staff are just exceptional. So, you know, Austin's in a good place when it comes to, you know, the medical staff and mostly our interface with the doctors was very good. There's some very good physicians out there. And you spoke about the empowered patients, the e-patients, and it's sketchy as to whether they believe in having empowered patients because I had to really step in because, they were talking past Clarissa and past me, basically saying what they're going to do and didn't want to hear any questions. And we had plenty of questions, so I had to kind of assert myself saying I'm not a medical illiterate. Yeah, I've been there and done that, so let's talk. And then they'd kind of be grumpy. But, you know, most of them, you know, came around and said, okay, you know, this is what we're going to do and this is why we're doing it. And that's what you really have to do when you're dealing with medical people is don't play dumb. Even if you are dumb, don't play dumb. Ask questions. It's your body. It's your health. And if you don't find out what they're doing, you're just saying, okay, here's my body. Do what you want to with it. And that could be either good or bad.
Yeah, I mean, the argument that we've made through, I was a co-founder of something called the Society for Participatory Medicine. And one of the basic tenets of that participatory medicine philosophy is that the healthcare professionals should see the patient as part of the healthcare team. And when you do that, everything goes much better, generally speaking. Sometimes people aren't really up to being part of the team. But in general, the patient knows the patient's body and condition better than anybody because they're having the experience. They can contribute to the discussion parts that would otherwise be missed. So it's real important to include them as part of the team. And it works better if your default assumption is that they're going to be able to hold up their end as part of the team, or they will have some representative who can do that. And if you do find yourself in a situation in a hospital where you're like kind of stuck in the bed and can't really do much yourself, it's really pretty critical to have somebody there who can act in your behalf. We had someone that we are close to had a bad fall and was actually stuck in a garage for a couple of days in the cold. This was recent. At the hospital, when they arrived at the hospital, they had a relative who was a nurse who showed up and had some very interesting stories about all the difficulties that they had coordinating and making sure things were covered. And somebody would say that they had done something that they hadn't actually done. I mean, if you're not keeping an eye on the ball yourself, you can't assume that the healthcare professionals are doing it for you. This doesn't diminish them in any way. It's just that they got a lot of stuff on their plate and they're really busy and they have a lot of stuff going on and they're trying to keep track of everything as well as they can. It's critical for you to be part of that team, having some input, making sure that they are on top of things, making sure that they're clear with you and that you're clear with them. Because without that, really terrible things can happen.
Yeah, there were a few instances during both. She had two different hospital stays because, to give you a little history there, she was inpatient for the broken ankle, and they did severe surgery and had a lot of bracing in there. And then she came home for home care. I had home care nurses coming in. And unfortunately, the surgical site became infected. So I had to rush her back to Del Seton. And after much treatment, they decided that there was no way to save the lower right leg. So she had to have her leg amputated below the knee on the right leg. And that was pretty traumatic. So, it's a lot to deal with, both of those stays. But one thing, most of the time, the doctors were really good, but occasional practitioners, because you get a lot, it's not just, one main surgeon. There's lots of people, anesthesia, vascular care, surgical nurses, all these people.
And those are workers.
Yeah, and them too. And they come in, and immediately you will know whether they really have looked into what's up with this patient, what their history is, if they've even looked at their medical records, which, Seton does have, extensive medical records on my wife because she's been seen there a few times. So I had to stop them and say, have you, because the things they're saying, it's obvious they don't know her medical condition. She has multiple sclerosis also. And they'd be saying, we're going to do all this physical therapy for you. It's like, well, wait, she was always mobility impaired before the injury. So obviously you don't know what her medical history. Would you please read the records and then we'll talk? And boy, get the, I know what I'm doing. It's like, well, you know what you're doing if you know what's happening in the life of this patient, what they've had before, what they've been experiencing, because that can impact your medical decision. And you know, some of them would say, well, that makes a lot of sense. And they'd go away and come back and they knew what they were supposed to do based on her medical records. But some were just insulted by the, you dare to question me, you lowly human? It's like, okay, we won't deal with you. But you'll experience a range of those things. But fortunately, you know, most of the people at Del Seton were just fine.
Yeah, I had one of those guys. He tried to kill me.
Oh, good.
He was a cardiologist. And, I have had occasional bouts of AFib, very rare. But when it happens, it happens. And one was lasting a bit longer than I was comfortable with. So we went to the emergency room and, you know, I was already on a medication for AFib and he was going to put me on a different medication. And if I had not been conscious and aware and listening to what they were talking about doing, I might not have caught it, but they were going to give me this other medication that would not have played well with the one I was already taking. And it would have been kind of a bad scene. So they don't always get really clear about all those things. They don't always check. They should have already known that I was taking the other medication. It was in my record, you know. But in part, the problem there was that they didn't have a cardio in that particular hospital. So it was a guy at a different hospital and they were just going to follow his guidance, you know, and he was giving his guidance without seeing me or really even attending to my record.
Well, it's good that he didn't succeed in extinguishing your life. But, you know, my wife had a similar thing happen to her when she was much younger and was living in the Bay Area. And she went to a doctor because she had stomach problems. You know, her stomach was upset and having stomach pains. And he gave her belladonna. And if you know what belladonna is, it's also known as deadly nightshade.
Yeah.
And I was surprised that that was even administered for any purpose other than killing someone. And it almost did. She started immediately going into a shock and being basically paralyzed from the effects of the belladonna. And she was having an allergic reaction to it. So
belladonna has a medicinal use that...
Well, apparently it did back then, but none of the other doctors we've spoken to when we said what her allergy was to, when they'd go, we've never heard of that. And these are experienced medical people. And they're like, why would they give her that? And apparently the doctor that gave her that ended up being fired because he almost killed her. So she was rushed to another hospital where they knew what the hell they were doing. And they were able to stabilize her. But the doctor that stabilized her ended up calling the doctor at the other hospital and cursing at him for trying to kill this little woman. So it happens. That's why you really have to be a partner in your care. I've been inpatient a few times, and I always wanted to know exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it. And you have a right as a human being to know that stuff. You know, you're not just checking into the hospital and say, "Well, here's my body. Do what you want." You know, it's like, no, you need to ask questions, and you need to wait until you get the answers that tell you exactly what they're going to do to your body.
Wow. Indeed. Well, there are physicians and a number of physicians, and some of them are aligned with the society that I mentioned, the participatory medicine, who are kind of dedicated to this idea that the patient should be a partner, should be part of a team. And they talk about the patient being in the driver's seat. And this, you know, this idea, this philosophy actually came from the work of Tom Ferguson, Dr. Tom Ferguson, the late Dr. Tom Ferguson. He died some years ago. But Tom was a physician who spent more time actually writing about medicine and healthcare. And he published a magazine called Medical Self-Care. And he was a medical editor for the Whole Earth Catalog. And Tom was really dedicated to this idea that people should be as smart as they can get, you know, about their own bodies and their own conditions, and should be encouraged to be as knowledgeable as they can be and as aware as they can be, and should be encouraged to work with the healthcare team. And they came up with this label for that kind of patient, the e-patient, which some people thought electronic patient, because he, part of it was that Tom, when the internet first appeared, which is when I met him, knew immediately what the potential was for people with various healthcare conditions to be able to research their own health and their own conditions, and also find others who have same or similar conditions and have meaningful interaction with those other folks, where they could sort of crowdsource knowledge and research. So to him, the e-patient was in part, you know, a patient who could facilitate their education about their bodies and their conditions by access to electronic information sources, the internet, but also E was for empowered, the empowered patient, the patient who is empowered by this knowledge and who's empowered by their partnership with their healthcare team, which also meant, you know, so this meant in part bringing in patient activists. And we did a lot of that kind of work on Twitter, especially. And patient activists have become more vocal and more powerful and more aware of each other, and have worked together quite a bit through social media. Yeah. So Tom, you know, has sort of opened the door to this and wrote a white paper about e-patients, which is still available online at the site for it's participatorymedicine.org. And in fact, patient communities have formed where people share information about their conditions. And you know, it's not uncommon to hear somebody explain how their life was actually saved by doing work and research online and getting information from other people with similar conditions and going back to their healthcare provider with some of this information and maybe finding a clinical trial that would save them, or finding a pathway into treatment that would, you know, help them quite a bit. It's very powerful for patients to work together, and patient communities have become a pretty big deal. And you find them all over the place. I mean, you find them on in places that are like dedicated to a particular thing. There's one, let's see, what is it? I think it's How Stuff Works, pulls a bunch of people together to talk about different individual approaches to different conditions, like tinnitus or tinnitus is one, you know, AFib is another one. And there's Reddit subreddits that are dedicated to specific conditions where there's a lot of good information there. Obviously, there can be bad information, and obviously there can be people online who are spreading incorrect information or misinformation. And there's one valid reason that physicians are concerned about people using the internet quite a bit is that they can go down the wrong path.
Then you get down the wrong rabbit hole.
Yeah, and you talk about the physician who says, I know what I'm doing, you know, don't try to tell me what to do. But you can find this in patients too. So I did the research online and I know damn well that this is what needs to happen. And, you know, a physician may know full well that that's not what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. So there's that complication, you know, and there has to be some balance. But overall, there is a need for patients to be as involved as possible in their health care. And there's so many ways to do that now.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, the whole thing of the internet providing information, there's all sorts of information, good, bad, dangerous, stupid, just, you know, Trump level made up. But I've run across some really great resources thanks to talking to the people at the hospitals that we've been to. And you know, my wife now being an amputee, she had a person visit that was working with Del Seaton about getting a prosthesis, you know, for to replace the missing limb. And this woman, it turned out to be a great resource. She lost her leg in a motorcycle accident quite some time ago and got a prosthetic leg and decided she would help other people in that situation get the best possible care. You know, if that's what they need is a prosthetic device, you know, she can talk them through it. She can tell them what they need to do, and she's actually due to come out and check up on Clarissa's leg, make sure it's healing correctly for the prosthetic, because you know it's a specialized thing, and it's really quite involved from what we've learned. But she gave us contacts for a lot of support groups, you know, for caregivers, for amputees, for family members that, you know, really help you cope with, you know, what you're going through and gives you good information. And it's so important to know where this information is coming from, because there's lots of well-meaning people say, oh, yeah, you've got to go to this website. They know everything about curing cancer or curing male pattern baldness or whatever. And it turns out it's just, you know, another rabbit hole that someone dug and they're making money off of it probably.
I absolutely know a cure for baldness.
And that is?
Grow some hair.
Well, let me.
It works every time.
Let me get in touch with the statesman. I'm sure they may want to make a headline out of that. Lebkoski says.
Oh, yes, the statesman that used to be the Austin newspaper.
Yes. I'm not sure what they are now, but they still show up every day-ish.
You know, they're going to stop their Saturday delivery.
Yeah, I got that email. Yeah, I accessed them online for you know, quite a long time. I got the print copy. You know, I was just, you know, I'm old school in a lot of ways. I just like the tactile thing of having your news and you can feel it and run through the paper. But I was paying $1,000 a month for that. It's like, no, not a month. It's $1,000 a year for that privilege. Like,
yeah.
Now that's dumb because I could pay like $10 a month and get it electronically. It's like, duh.
Well, we've been getting it all along. I don't really touch it myself, but Marcia likes to read it. I was just thinking about getting a bird. You know, if you've got a bird cage, you really have a use for that newspaper.
Okay. Well, I found it was useful for starting the charcoal for my smoker. You know, that's the only reason I kept copies of the paper. Now I'm starting to run out, so I have to find some other publication to sacrifice to the barbecue gods.
It's pretty handy if you have to pack something. You know, you can wrap it in newspaper.
Tell me about it when we moved from the Bay Area.
I mean, I don't know what we'd do for that, really.
When we moved from the Bay Area to Texas, I remember packing many. My wife has a lot of dishes and a lot of china and stuff, and I'm carefully wrapping it in all sorts of bubble wrap and newspaper. And boy, getting rid of that stuff at the other when we got here, that was a major problem.
I always thought they should print newspapers on bubble wrap. But nobody seems to think that's a good idea. Okay. I don't really understand.
Yeah, I hope you're taking all this down, folks. All you would-be entrepreneurs, John is a resource for interesting concepts.
Well, and we should probably talk about the news. I think that by the time we have published this podcast, everything will have changed. So talking about specific current events, you know, I don't know how useful that is, but it's interesting to just kind of look at the coverages of things and how discussions are going on. And particularly in the United States right now, I'm obviously, you know, we're in the midst of an international crisis with Russia having invaded Ukraine. And across the world, people are taking action in support of Ukraine. But there has been a growing body of political actors in the United States who support Russia and support Putin, and also have become pretty active within the Republican Party. And I think that there's been quite a bit of confusion over the last week within the Republican Party, especially like, should we feel good about what Putin's doing, or should we be upset with Putin? Should we think it's okay that everybody else in the world is sort of taking action, sometimes symbolic actions, sometimes actual concrete actions, you know, sometimes like blocking funds, making sure that banks in Russia can't get money, that kind of thing, removing them from access to SWIFT. All those things are happening, and there's a kind of stutter and stammer among the people who in the U.S. have been supporting the cause of the Russians and of Putin, including Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump.
Oh, no, I didn't know they were going to be dishonest about what's happening.
Well, you know, and maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Maybe they're seeing the handwriting on the wall.
Yeah. Well, the whole Republican Party thing of supporting Russia is a massive irony. If you and I are of a certain age to where we were around for Cold War 1.0, and the Republican Party was very adamant about we need to get rid of the Russians and Russia is bad, and people like Putin, who was part of the KGB, which were the bad guys, and the Republican Party was really against all those guys. Suddenly they're their heroes. They're folk heroes for, you know, I guess fascist, but still. It's just ironic to hear all these Republicans who, you know, going on about freedoms, but it's like, well, somebody's stomping on someone's freedom, but it's your guy, so it's okay.
Yeah, it's kind of a peculiar period here. And I really, you know, I've been reading these things and I really don't know quite what to expect. At one point, we thought that democracy was really challenged and practically done for. And damned if the Ukrainians aren't standing up for that concept of democracy and fighting really hard for it. And it kind of makes me think that we here in the U.S. should be prepared to put up that kind of fight. And we might find ourselves having to put up that kind of fight sooner rather than later, and with other people who live in the U.S. who seem to want to go in another direction.
People who drive trucks around the country waving the Trump flag and hoping to shut down government. That's a bit of a scary thing. I mean, they were bad enough in Canada, and fortunately Canada saw the what was going on and put an end to it. But of course, that just drove it down here. And of course, the people in that Republican ultra-conservative milieu, they are just, you know, loving the whole concept. We can go screw the government again. Let's get our trucks.
Well, but, you know, they think that they're screwing the government in the name of freedom. And in a way, they think that you have to overthrow democracy in order to be free, or you have to have an authoritarian leader in order to be free. And that's very confusing, too. It's sort of hard to understand that thinking. But I really don't think that, you know, even the people who like broke into the Capitol and attacked the Capitol, what they did was terrible. They did a horrible thing. But I think in their own minds, they thought they were being patriots. Some of them did.
Yeah. You know, well, one of those people is going on
this
trial.
This is a sign that maybe there's been some pretty successful propaganda at work. People have been brainwashed a bit.
Well, one of those people is going on trial very soon in Washington, D.C., and he's from Texas, of course. And he threatened his children, and they're going to be testifying against him. They ratted him out because he came home from the insurrection and said, "Don't you go telling anyone what I've done, because that would make you a traitor. And you know what they do to traitors? They shoot them." And those kids went, "We're going to the cops." But that's the kind of people we're dealing with. We're not dealing with the rational William F. Buckley kind of conservatives. We're dealing with the, you know, they think conservative is cool because you can go and carry guns and give people a hard time and scream and yell and interrupt meetings, and that's all sorts of fun. But there's no intellectual commitment to conservatism on their part.
Well, and you know, they're just on one side of a wedge, right? Somebody drove a wedge between people in this country, and rational conversation has stopped. And there's some people who are feeling such strong emotions about what they believe, you know, what they believe to be true, that they can't do what we really need to do, which is sit down and have a rational discussion about how to proceed, how to move forward. We have huge issues that we should be dealing with. And we have people who have been elected supposedly to be leaders and deal with those issues who are not doing any of that. They're spending all of their time playing political games and scoring points, owning the libs, or like, I mean, it happens on the left and the right both, but the right's been particularly bad lately about this stuff. And it's because, you know, from my perspective, I think they've been sold a bill of goods. They've been worked over by a bunch of con men.
Yes.
And those Tucker con men have a lot of skin in the game.
Yeah. And the whole thing, there's a lot of whining about cancel culture. And all of a sudden, they're cancel culture. Let's burn those books. Let's ban those books. Let's ban those teachers. Let's fire anybody that makes our kids uncomfortable because of their history. And if that's not cancel culture, I don't know what is. But boy, they were making all sorts of sounds about cancel culture before.
And I guess that we're at a point now where, you know, we thought that the danger of nuclear war was past. And I suspect that it won't be long before in elementary schools, if we still have elementary schools, some people are trying to like do away with the school system. But if we do continue to have schools, people will again be hiding under their desks so that they'll have a little bit of shelter when they're being incinerated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think schools should be required to show the student body, you know, every year a certain number of movies, start perhaps with On the Beach and then Dr. Strangelove. And there's many more, but that's what happens with real nuclear warfare. It's not some heroic thing where, you know, you're going to ride the nuclear bomb, you know, into the target like, was it Slim Pickens that did that? And, you know, it's a lot more dire. It means the extinction. If you watch the old 80s movie War Games, that's very, telling in how a war can start. It can just be some whack job says, let's just turn it over to the computers. And you know how good that can be or how bad it can be. Garbage in, garbage out is the old saying. And if your leaders push the button, the computer's going to go, okay, let's fire those rockets.
You know, I think one of the problems that we have, and I've talked about this before, I've talked about how we've been exposed to science fiction for so long that some of the science fiction tropes, some of the, you know, concepts that have been so much a part of science fiction, even though they're not real, it's like not an existing thing. And a good example is time travel. Mm-hmm. I think people sort of assume that time travel is possible and it'll happen sooner or later. There's absolutely no reason to think that we'll ever be able to travel through time, but it's such a great device to use in a science fiction story. And we've seen so many science fiction stories about time machines and time travel that we, in the back of our minds, we kind of buy it. We kind of believe it. Same thing about, you know, space travel. I mean, it could be that humans are never going to be able to travel in space. We don't really know whether we can survive long term if we leave the planet. There's all kinds of issues. And this, you know, we don't know that if we go to another planet that we would survive 10 minutes before that planet's form of bacteria has completely destroyed us. We just don't know, you know. So, but our head is full of assumptions about what's real. And we're sort of addicted to these fictions, you know. A lot of the conversations I have with people are about the television shows that we watch. And I'm certainly not exempting myself from this. I'm one of the worst.
Oh, you and me both.
I'm constantly filling my head with shit. But the problem is that I think you get to a point where you don't really seriously believe that what's happening is happening. And I think that, you know, this idea of a nuclear winter, you know, a nuclear mutually assured destruction it's almost like we don't take it seriously. It's kind of like just more fiction, more of a game. You know, people mm-hmm. love to get into games right now. And a lot of the games are games where people are shooting each other. And then after you get shot and killed, you get back up again, you know, and you might have some number of lives or so much health or whatever.
Yeah, you've got more
to be able to persist and persist, even though you've been killed over and over again.
Yeah, you don't get extra lives.
I really think that this is getting into people's heads. I think they're really starting to get too far from what's real and not realize that, like, a nuclear blast would incinerate actual people, and it would be a horrible, horrible thing. And if people got out in the streets and started shooting at each other, when the bullet hits, it may kill you, and you're not going to get back up. Your health isn't going to regenerate you. You're just going to be dead.
You don't get extra lives like you do in video games. And if anyone who's followed science fiction like you and I have, John, for years and years, a lot of that fiction has become fact. And, a lot of it hasn't. But, there are some of those, fictional stories that you look back at them and it's like, that actually is happening now. Yeah. And so you have to be careful. And the flip side of the coin of you saying that we might not be able to exist in space, if we do exist in space and travel to other planets, we may be the next Christopher Columbus. We may be bringing, gonorrhea to innocent planets, or our bacteria or whatever. Like, the Native Americans didn't have those STDs until the Spanish and the Portuguese and the Dutch and whoever else was coming in, showed up and colonized and spread their influence and also spread their diseases. We may be the next disease carrier.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll recall that it saved our asses in War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
I think, though, it could be that there's a sequel to the War of the Worlds where the humans catch the germs from the Martians and they all start dying, too, and pretty much everybody's gone.
And in a case like that, the Earth wins. I mean, it's gotten rid of a couple of viral diseases, aliens from outer space and human beings.
Yep, absolutely. No more vaccinations because no more humans to vaccinate.
Boy, aren't we being cheerful, y'all?
Oh, yeah, I know. We're very apocalyptic right now.
I got your apocalypse now.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we have not gone for the whole hour, but I'm running out of things to say, and I'm starting to depress myself. You got anything cheery that we can discuss?
Cheery.
Cheerios?
I have nothing.
I can talk about going vegan.
Oh, I saw that post. Tell me, what lured you over to the land of tofu and plants?
Well, Marcia and I have discussed this before, and the discussion is usually me saying, I'd really like to be a vegetarian or a vegan. I think I would like that diet better. I think that would be better for me. And her saying, you're crazy. I'm not going to do that. She hadn't really wanted to do it. She likes to eat meat. She likes to eat cheese. And she doesn't, she doesn't love the idea of giving all that up. On the other hand, I have had several things going on. Part of it is my belief that just me and my unique body, everybody's body is kind of unique to them. And I believe that I work better when I'm not eating animal products, when I'm plant-based, whole foods plant-based. So that's part of it. And then I also have had this growing concern based on my understanding that the way that we produce meat, I say produce meat, I mean, animals produce more animals, so they're really producing the meat. So the ways that we process meat to like put it into stores so you can just go buy packages of it and eat it, that's having an impact on the climate, the environment, it has all sorts of consequences that we don't really consider very well. And I'm not even sure that I don't think I know what they all are, but I do know, Vinay Gupta told me one time, and I think there's something to this, that if we just stopped producing so many cattle for consumption, that the levels of methane would drop in a significant way, and that would have an impact on our climate problem.
Put an end to cow farts.
Yeah, put an end to cow farts, basically, or at least not have so many of them. So I'm concerned about that. And then there is the ethics of the way animals are treated. And, you know, it's really pretty horrible. If you learn anything about, I mean, the best they can do is just not think about it and not ever go to a slaughterhouse. Don't ever think about what's actually happening there, how the meat is being produced. It just shows up and you don't really have to think about it. But I'm one of those guys who at one point or another starts thinking about it. And it bothers me. I really don't like the way animals are treated. I mean, I think there are ethical ways to get meat in relationship with your natural environment and the animals therein. And you know, you might eat some meat sometimes. But we have factory production or processing of animals that we slaughter, and we don't treat them very well before they're slaughtered. And we don't, I guess it's probably pretty quick and painless when they kill the animal, but it's not just that they kill the animal. It's how the animal is caged and treated up to that point, you know?
Yeah, factory farms and ranches. Yeah, I've also for a long time been opposed to that. I do all the, you know, in our house, I do all the cooking. I do all the groceries because, you know, Clarissa no longer can go out and do those things. It's been that way for quite a while. So I look at the labels. I look at the companies that are making these things. You know, I approach it more, you know, being of Native American ancestry, I've done a lot of reading about the traditions of the various tribes, particularly our own tribe, the Choctaw of Oklahoma, and how they approached animal meat, you know, consuming animals. And the tradition was always you would go out, you know, this was a long time ago, you would go out and kill an animal for your family to eat. But when you did that, you thanked the animal for the meat that they're giving to you. It's like a reverse on the saying a prayer, you know, to God or whomever before your meal. But the prayer was really a thank you to the animal for giving us food. And you try not to do anything really horrendous. You know, there's all sorts of ways of getting your meat. And I have to confess, yeah, I'm a carnivore. I eat the meat, and I like my cheese too. So I have to, you know, sympathize with Marcia on that. But, you know, there are ways to pick what you're doing in your life and what you're putting in your body. And it pretty much has to be an individual, you know, choice, because what's good for one person may not be great for another. So you just have to look at what you're doing to yourself with the food and drink and whatever, and adjust those intakes to things that are good for you and avoid the things that are bad for you. That's as far as I go to regulating my diet.
Well, I have put a lot of time into a study of health and nutrition, especially as it pertains to me, but also more in general. And it's really clear to me that that the average person consumes way more meat than they should or than they need, and that it has an impact on their health, and that the healthiest approach to diet is a whole foods plant-based diet, maybe with some meat, maybe not. But I'm very aware of that, and I've been exposed to some things. That the thing that we were talking about, and this was Marcia and I taking a walk and talking about how at our age we should be really sensitive to the potential to have a stroke. And how might you change your nutrition in order to be less apt to have a stroke? And I said, well, you know, I had read up on and studied the Engine 2 diet by Rip Ezelstein, which is really a vegan diet, but more restrictive. And it's more restrictive particularly in that it omits oils. You know, you don't use oils and fats. And people who go on that diet tend to be, you know, they lose weight because of the restrictions. Obviously, you're not eating cheese and you're not eating really any fats for the most part. And I said, I thought, you know, that would probably be a good thing to do. Let's look at the Engine 2 diet. And I had the original Engine 2 diet book, and I got another, there's a more recent book about it that I got, and I read up on that. And, you know, I'm flipping through that, and everything in there is, I kind of know. I by now I know a lot of these things about nutrition and why you should or shouldn't do certain things. I'm not completely on board with the restriction against oils, which is not, you know, I mean, on a vegan diet, you wouldn't eat cheese because it's animal based, but they do have vegan cheeses that are made, I think, usually with coconut oil.
Yeah, there are plenty of vegetable oils.
Coconut oil is a saturated
oils.
Fat, you know, it's a pretty heavy duty oil. So we're kind of on the fence about that part of it. We've still done some cooking with olive oil. We subscribe to a service called Purple Carrot. We're about to get a shipment tomorrow, I think. And that's one of these meal services where they deliver you the ingredients so you can prepare some number of meals every week. And it's vegan. And I subscribed to it because I thought it would help me. It's sort of like Christmas, you know. You decide you're going to eat a really different way, and it just opens a lot of doors. There's so many things that you can learn and that you can, you know, that you can find that fit into that diet. And if you feel like you've been in a rut with your diet and your nutrition, it's a great thing to make a change like this. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, it's a big project. So I'll get these meal kits and start making the meals, and hopefully I'll get even better at producing fairly well balanced vegan meals, make sure that we get the protein that we need. Well, you kind of have to take vitamin D supplements, which we were already doing, and B12, I was taking B12 too. I'm taking more of it now. But I think, you know, this is where I want to go from now on. I don't know how long I'm going to be around, but this seems like the sane way to eat going forward. And, you know, I went on a fairly restrictive weight loss diet a couple of years ago, and I gained some of that weight back, probably about 2/3 of it, really. And this will reverse that.
Well, I have to speak up for the loyal opposition. Had many friends over the years. You know, I've lived in Berkeley, Oakland, San Francisco, Houston, now the Austin area, and got to meet a lot of people who had various diet regimens that they swore by. And unfortunately, a lot of the ones who were saying, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to eat meat, I'm going to eat just a few little vegetables here, and they left us pretty early. And so I think my opinion of watching what they were doing, that they were doing an extreme version of, you know, good eating. And sometimes the extremes can be just as bad in one direction as in the other. You know, I shouldn't be eating huge amounts of meat, but I like to eat the meat. I like to drink the drink. I love my wine. I love an occasional martini.
Yeah, Engine 2 diet does away with alcohol.
And I don't want to be
one
of those.
That's another issue I have with that diet.
Yeah, I don't want to be one of those guys that reaches the end of the road and said, oh, you know, I didn't do any of that stuff that I hear was pretty good, and now it's too late. It's like, I'm just going to burn that old candle, and when it's gone, say hasta la vista. And
well, there's also the Arnold Schwarzenegger version of the vegan diet. Schwarzenegger started eating a vegan diet. You know, he had severe heart problems, and you know, a guy who's got all that muscle, mm-hmm. it's as bad as being big and fat.
Yep,
you know,
yep.
it can cause similar issues. And he had a severe heart attack at one time. He became a vegan, but he doesn't consider himself a vegan is really, if you talk about being vegan, that's because you're doing it for ethical reasons, because you don't want to eat any animal products because you don't approve of the way animals are treated, right? So that's vegan, really. The other way to characterize it is plant-based whole foods diet, which says that you eat plants and you eat whole foods, and you've primarily eliminated meat. But in Schwarzenegger's case, he eats a steak every now and then.
Yeah.
He says, well, you know, I just, to balance it out, I mean, I'm not, he says he's like 80% plant-based whole foods. So that's, I think, healthier than the typical Western or American diet. And certainly there's, you know, in a vegan diet, you could, there's such thing as vegan junk food, and you can have a pretty unhealthy vegan diet. You can eat just garbage, basically, but it's vegan garbage. You know, yeah. It's plant-based. It may not be whole foods, but it's plant-based stuff.
Well, we're drawing near to the end of our hour.
Oh, my God. We did. We did it. We filled the hour.
Yeah, well, and boy, did we fill it. We just lumped that stuff in there. So I think
so. We talked about health a lot, and we talked a little bit about how the world is blowing up.
Yeah, and I think we can do this more often because, you know, we are opinionated gentlemen and not afraid to spout our beliefs into your ears. And we hope you will join us again.
Yeah, if you were crazy enough to listen to this whole episode all the way to the end, let me just say, send us your cards and letters or your tweets, and let us know what you want us to talk about.
Indeed. So we'll see you down the road, John. I'm sure we'll be on the air on YouTube on Thursday, and we'll be on Radio Free Plutopia on Wednesday. So, hey, we're going to have gangs of fun now that I'm back home and functioning.
Welcome back, Scoot.
Thank you, John. And I guess it's time to say bye-bye.
Over and out.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.